Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. On today's episode, Another Life.
So the story begins in 1974 in a persimmon orchard near Xi'an, China, and laborers are digging deeply in search of a new water supply. And they literally stumble upon broken pieces of terracotta pottery that they immediately recognize are not naturally occurring because they look like parts of bodies. They look like faces and arms and hands.
What they found was the massive burial ground of the first emperor of China, Qin Shi Huang, who died over 2,000 years ago. An underground empire filled with thousands of life-size statues of soldiers made from terracotta.
They line the corridors ready for battle to protect the first emperor in the afterlife.
And now, several of these ancient clay soldiers have just arrived in Philadelphia for a new exhibit at the Franklin Institute. Karen E. Linich is director of science content here.
This is our infantryman. One thing to notice when you look at the infantryman is that both of his hands are poised.
These soldiers stood watch for over 2,000 years, and now they are touring the world, teaching us about Chinese history, about warfare, burial practices, manufacturing techniques.
The first emperor thought of this as his army for eternity, his army to protect him for eternity, and in fact, it's really turned out that they are his ambassadors for eternity, and they are his emissaries around the world.
They have a whole new life. And that's what we'll explore today, how things and people can morph and change, take on new roles, stage a comeback. Cell phone towers become refrigeration stations for vaccines. A beloved pet turns into home decor, and an outdated navigation system is back online. Our first story is about giving another life to our bodies after death. A lot of people compost their kitchen and garden waste, veggie scraps, banana peels, stale tortilla chips, grass clippings, you name it. You wait for a bit for all that material to break down, and the result is dirt that's rich in nutrients. So you take a waste product and turn it into a new resource. What if we could do that with our bodies? That's a question some environmentalists and people who study death are asking. Ashley Ahern is the host of the podcast Terrestrial, and she brings us this story.
I was about 12 years old when my great aunt Gilda died. I adored her. When I was little, she used to sneak me candy from her purse when no one was looking and then just smile impishly at our secret. She was this tiny Italian-American lady. I mean, 5 foot nothing, black hair, sparkly, mischievous eyes. She had an open casket Catholic funeral, and I remember walking up to the edge and looking in. It was Aunt Gilda, but there was something weird about her. She had foundation makeup all over her face that gave her this artificial dark tan coloring, and then on each cheek there was this big round circle of blush. She was dead, but it was almost like she'd been remade in Technicolor to look aggressively alive. That image has stuck with me ever since. It just seemed so unnatural. Great Aunt Gilda's body had been filled with embalming fluid to preserve it. She'd been placed in an expensive hardwood casket and put into the ground in a concrete-lined space. And that all masked the fact that not only was she gone, but her body was starting to decay. What we choose to do with our bodies when we die has an environmental impact. That embalming fluid my great aunt had been preserved with, it's made with formaldehyde, which is a carcinogen. And in the US, we put an estimated 8 Olympic-sized swimming pools of that stuff underground in dead bodies every year. And what about the wood that made her casket? When you tally up all the people who die and choose a wooden casket like hers, we're putting enough wood underground to make an estimated 1,800 single-family homes every year. Next, think about all the space cemeteries take up. Some big cities around the country have actually banned new cemeteries because there just isn't any more room. You could choose cremation, but that releases hundreds of pounds of greenhouse gas emissions, not to mention small amounts of heavy metals. So all of that is why a Seattle architect started thinking about composting human bodies.
My name is Katrina Spade, and I'm the founder and director of the Urban Death Project.
Katrina launched the project in 2014, and she's done a couple small Kickstarter campaigns that have gathered supporters all over the country, from funeral attorneys to soil scientists. On paper, Katrina's designed what she calls a recomposition center, a facility where it would be possible to compost human bodies. I realize this is pretty out there for a lot of people. I know the Catholic side of my family would probably freak, but here's how Katrina envisions one of these centers.
When you open the doors to the recomposition center, the first thing you see is this three-story concrete form. It ends, you can see the top of it. And wrapping around that core is a series of ramps that sort of meander.
The core would be filled with alternating layers of pine chips and human bodies at various phases of decomposition. And it'd be warm to the touch because of the heat released by those bodies as they break down. Walkways would encircle the core, leading from the ground level up to the top. And when someone dies, their loved ones would carry the body up the walkway to an opening the size of a single grave. Inside is a clean bed of wood chips.
Friends and family lower the body in on top of that bed and cover the body with wood chips. That's the moment when you say goodbye.
But before Katrina can make her vision a reality and actually build one of these centers, there are some basic scientific questions to be answered. How long does it take to fully compost a body? And if you're trying to do more than one at a time, how do you speed up the process and make sure everything, you know, bones, teeth, all of us, breaks down? She's gathered a team of experts to try to answer these questions, experimenting with composting real human bodies at an outdoor research facility in North Carolina. I was nervous about how that would feel, to see another human being start to decompose. Student volunteers from Western Carolina University were mixing alfalfa pellets, corn, and straw to make a mulchy bed. The man they were going to start composting had died a few weeks earlier in a nearby hospital, and he wanted his body donated to science. He was in an opaque plastic body bag in the grass near our feet, and I just kept asking Katrina scientific, detail-oriented questions about the process, because that's what I do when I'm nervous, right? Like, what makes a good mix to compost human bodies? Or how high will the temperature spike in the compost pile?
Okay, looks good.
We laid the bag gently on top of the mulch pile, and then Katrina unzipped it. The man was still wearing the hospital gown he died in. His white hair stuck out at odd angles from his face, and his mouth was open. And there was this white fuzz of fungus blooming in his eye sockets and his nostrils. I clutched my microphone and just tried to stay focused, but I couldn't help it. I wondered about his family, about his wife, and whether she's still alive. What would she think if she were here?
Mm-hmm. And then we should take off the hospital gown as well.
And then the man is naked, just a human body. His ribs jutting upwards away from the earth, his stomach sunken below, white flesh, almost like he'd been underwater for a while. I squat down next to him, I'm wearing gloves at this point, and I reach out and touch his leg. It's surprisingly soft, the skin somehow not quite right, like not quite fully attached to the flesh and bones beneath it. As the team started covering him with mulch, I just stood there looking, and this feeling of calm came over me. This was just a human being starting to decompose. And this will happen to all of us one day. Nature would take over from here. In some cultures, the natural decomposition process gets a bit of help. This is a recording of a sky burial, a Tibetan Buddhist practice. Dead bodies have been laid out in an open field, and you can hear the vultures calling to one another as they slowly gather around. The birds will feed on the remains until there's nothing left but bones. If you think about it, that practice isn't too far removed from choosing to have your body composted when you die. So how might people of different faiths respond to the Urban Death Project, that idea that we could compost human bodies? I asked Professor Amir Hussein of Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles. He studies death and burial practices in the major world religions. For Buddhists and Hindus, he didn't think the idea would be a big stretch.
And in many ways, there may be a drawing to it, this idea of returning back to the earth, this idea of connecting back to creation.
In the Jewish and Muslim traditions, burials are pretty minimalistic. It's about returning the body to the earth with the least interference necessary. But Amir thinks Christians could be divided in how they respond to the idea of composting a human body. On one hand, he said a lot of the Christians he knows embrace the idea of returning to the earth when they die, the whole idea of dust to dust. But
I could see a subset of my Christian friends going, why would you do this? This is an abomination. You know, don't you have any respect for your mother who bore you, and to put her like in some compost heap where she then goes to like, you know, feed someone's tomatoes?
Traditions are slow to change. But let's say architect Katrina Spade's idea takes hold and she raises the money to build the first recomposition center. Would that even be legal? The federal government doesn't regulate what we do with our bodies when we die. That happens at the state level, and it varies. But none of them have composting on the list of accepted ways to dispose of human bodies, which means that there's also no established permitting process for a facility like this. Then there's the issue of what's left. What could you do legally with the compost? Tanya Marsh is a professor at the Wake Forest School of Law who specializes in funeral and cemetery law. She said that composting human bodies comes down to a scientific question. Would the compost still be human remains or just compost?
The scientific answer is they are not human remains. It's just atoms, right? It's just molecules. Whether or not the law matches that understanding or not is something that we have to look at on a state-by-state basis. But I think clearly from a scientific standpoint, it's just compost.
So in theory, compost from the Urban Death Project could be used on crops, though it's more likely to be spread over flower gardens or forest land. As uncomfortable and futuristic as the idea of human composting might be for some people, Tanya said that what Katrina Spade is trying to do is actually more of a throwback to the past.
Which is more hands-on control over human remains in a more environmentally sensitive way. I mean, that's what we were doing 100 years ago. We didn't have them in the structures that she's talking about doing. But essentially what she's doing is trying to recapture something we've lost.
The funeral industry, with its open casket viewings and chemical preservation practices, is relatively young. In fact, embalming bodies wasn't popular in the U.S. until the Civil War, when wealthy families began paying to preserve the bodies of their sons and husbands who had died in battle so they could be sent home for burial. In reporting this story, I heard again and again from the people I interviewed that we as a society need to talk more about death and burial. Because right now, our choices are kind of limited, and the funeral industry is still in the early stages of embracing greener burial practices. But as more of us move to cities and we run out of green space and natural resources needed for traditional burial, maybe it's time to incorporate some new, or maybe I should say old, ideas about what we do with our bodies when we die. For The Pulse, I'm Ashley Ahern.
Ashley Ahern is the host of Terrestrial, a podcast from KUOW in Seattle that explores the choices we make in a world we have changed. We're talking about how people and things can morph, can take on new roles, get another life. And sometimes there is an aha moment of sorts when you realize maybe I could use this existing resource and do a whole other thing with it. Harvey Rubin had that kind of idea. He is a professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was watching television with a friend in 2010, right after a massive earthquake hit Haiti, and he saw a news story about a little boy who had diphtheria.
We had had in each hospital, he was re-diagnosed with diphtheria, which would have been the first.
And Harvey's friend said, I thought we had a vaccine against diphtheria.
And I said, we do, but probably the child either didn't get the vaccine at all or it had heated up and was inactivated. So we talked about the cold chain and the need to keep vaccines between 2 and 8 degrees.
That's 2 and 8 degrees Celsius, or 35 and 47 degrees Fahrenheit. Most vaccines need to be kept that cold until they're administered.
Because if they heat up or they freeze and thaw, then the biological properties of the vaccine itself will degenerate. And so it's just like you can't keep milk out forever and ever. These vaccines need to be kept cold or else they become inactive.
The steps that keep vaccines at the right temperature are called the cold chain, and maintaining a proper cold chain can be difficult in developing countries with warmer climates where energy sources are often scarce, like parts of Africa, Southeast Asia, South America. So where could these vaccines be stored and kept cold reliably? Harvey had an idea.
So when an academic solves a problem, what do? We write a paper. So a student of mine, Alice Conant, and I wrote a paper in The New Scientist where we suggested that, in fact, there's plenty of energy in the developing world to plug vaccine refrigerators into. Everybody said, oh, there's no energy, energy poverty, which is absolutely true. But when you think about where the energy is in the developing world, it's all in the private sector. And the private sector happens to be the cell towers. People always have cell phones, sometimes two or three. So we just said, use the power that's available at these very remote cell towers to power up the refrigerator and use the connectivity at the tower to monitor what's in the refrigerator. So we do both. We use the energy and the connectivity.
Describe to me what this looks like. I'm picturing a little refrigerator plugged into the bottom of a big tower.
Yeah, that's just about right. The only other difference is that we have to build a shelter to contain the refrigerator because you don't want it to be out in, exposed to the elements. And then you're right, it's just a cable into the bottom of the cell tower.
And so the drivers then distribute the vaccines to those refrigerators.
So right. So once that goes in place, the Ministry of Health takes it over, and they're just the way they would supply any other vaccine refrigerator. They have their workers go stock the refrigerator, and now it's distributed. So the healthcare worker doesn't have to schlep vaccines on a motorcycle or a camel to these various remote villages. It's right there.
How far have you spread this idea?
So it's up and running in Zimbabwe, and it has been for several years. We have this MOU, this Memorandum of Understanding with Ghana that's just about ready to be signed, and then also in Myanmar. And we have about 50 sites initially to go into Myanmar. And then I'm off to Australia, India, and South Africa next week. And in November, it's off to Nigeria to talk to our colleagues there, which is actually the University of Lagos.
So how exciting is it to see something go from a paper into action? I mean, that doesn't happen to academics all that often.
Right. And my family always remind me of that. Right. And my colleagues. You're absolutely right. You know, I've been working in academic medicine for 30, 40 years, and I've published papers on arcane aspects of enzymology and biochemical studies. I think this probably has the biggest impact of anything. And it's really, really satisfying. The World Health Organization estimates there are millions of kids who literally die every year because they don't get the vaccine. And those are the kids who die. But imagine how many more millions actually get sick. Not everybody who gets the disease will die, but they certainly get sick. So what happens when the child gets sick? Mom stays home to take care of them. So this is a huge impact on women as well. And if we can keep kids healthy, it has a tremendous empowering effect on women. And the economic impact on the villages is huge. These kids stay in school. The ripple effect of this is enormous.
Is there a takeaway point from what you've learned in terms of other work? You looked at a resource that was already there, mm-hmm. and you gave it another life, so
a
to
new
speak.
Life.
Yeah. So is there a takeaway point?
That is a great, great idea, actually. Now I'm going to steal that. The idea of repurposing or second purposing or relifing, which is, I think, a great expression, existing technology is something we have to start looking at because there are so many things out there that we could use for another purpose and actually enrich the communities that we go into.
Harvey Rubin is a doctor. His international vaccine storage effort is called Energize the Chain. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. Our next story is about relifing a chemical element, helium. It's the stuff that makes birthday balloons float and, of course, brings us endless hours of amusement.
Big breath this time.
Ooh, oh, there you go.
So funny.
Now you got a good one going.
In health and science, it's a very important and serious substance. We need it for MRIs. It's used in physics experiments and the semiconductors that go into smartphones, computers, all modern electronics. But the price for the very pure gas has more than doubled in the past few years, and that's a big problem for research. Alan Yu takes us to a university that now recycles its helium to save tens of thousands of dollars a year.
A few years ago, Sophia Hayes gave up her salary for 1 or 2 months over the summer. She's a chemist at Washington University in St. Louis.
Any decrease in salary is always a negative, and yet if it's the way to keep your research program going, that is what many of us do.
She gave up her salary to buy helium. Her research needs nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy, or NMR. It's related to the MRIs in hospitals, only you use this to look at molecules and chemical reactions. Both of these need powerful magnets, and these magnets need to be very cold. That's where the liquid helium comes in. It's a powerful coolant, and it has to be much purer than what's in balloons, which is partly why it costs so much.
Within the sciences, anytime you need to get to very low temperatures, you need this resource. There is no other substitute.
Sophia says liquid helium is a critical liquid, which she pays for with money from research grants, like from the National Science Foundation. But she can't go back to the funders and say, sorry, the price of helium doubled. Can you give me more money?
Think of being in your household and the price of gasoline triples or quadruples. How would you make ends meet on a budget when you have a fixed amount of money coming in?
Helium is a byproduct of natural gas extraction.
It's not so much that there's, you know, that the world's running out of helium. It's that the supply chain for helium is very, very sensitive to any disruption.
Mark Elsesser is a senior policy analyst at the American Physical Society. He says one reason that helium prices are so sensitive is that most of the time it isn't stored. Once we get it out of the ground, helium suppliers need to make sure they know someone is going to buy it from them. Mark says the volatile helium price is affecting what science does and does not get done in the US.
There are researchers who are exiting the field of low temperature physics because it's just become prohibitively expensive for them to have a research group. We're losing our nation's capacity to do that area of physics.
Remember, liquid helium is used to keep things cold. So after it does that, it gets hotter and becomes a gas again, which means it'll just evaporate into space. Some scientists don't want to see this expensive chemical just fly off the face of the Earth, so they made a machine that can recover helium gas and turn it into a liquid, give it another life. Jeff Sicker is a specialist who runs one of these machines at the University of Pittsburgh.
And now it will get loud. I want my headphones on. And we start.
The physics labs that use liquid helium have copper pipes to capture the helium once it turns back into a gas. Supervisor Tom Gassmeyer shows me where it goes.
This is our bag room. This is where the liquid helium, whenever it returns into a gas, is returns to. This is a 10,000 liter bag, big balloon.
It looks a little bit more like a gigantic, overinflated black air mattress. The gas eventually goes into a machine about the size of a big Xerox, where it's compressed. Then it goes to another machine, which uses liquid nitrogen to partially cool and purify the helium. Then it gets compressed again and expanded to lower the temperature. A portion of the cold gas at each stage circles back around to cool the incoming gas even more. Periodically, water, nitrogen, and other impurities get blasted out.
The water's louder than most things.
By the time you have liquid helium, it goes into a big silver thermos that's 6 feet tall.
You can feel it's getting cold.
It's very cold.
That'll freeze up.
By now, some of the pipes are so cold that there's a layer of frost on the surface. The system cost $4 million to build, but the university will recoup that cost in less than 10 years. And the physicist Patrick Irvin says it's saving the money year after year.
Since this system came online about 2.5 years ago, we've recovered about $200,000 worth of helium that we would have bought.
That's enough money to hire more staff and do more science. He shows me one experiment that he wouldn't be able to do without a helium recovery system. One where he looks at how electrons move in strong magnetic fields.
It just uses that much helium. Sometimes we can use 300 liters a week, which is, that's $3,000 per week.
Other universities have asked the University of Pittsburgh if they can buy the recycled helium, but they're scientists, not helium suppliers. Remember Sophia Hayes, who gave up her summer salary? She says her school is considering a small helium recovery system too.
Oh my goodness, you can't imagine. We are ecstatic.
If all goes well, it'll be in place in 6 months to a year. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
When a species hasn't been seen or heard from in about 50 years, it's usually declared extinct. But sometimes these creatures make an unexpected comeback. Take, for example, the woolly flying squirrel of Pakistan.
The woolly flying squirrel is the largest squirrel in the world. It's 4 feet long from the tip of its nose to the tip of its tail. It looks something like a raccoon. But it has a head of a squirrel, and in fact, the tail is large and long and cylindrical, much like red foxes.
That's Peter Zahler from the Wildlife Conservation Society. This squirrel, which is called Sergei by locals, had not been documented since 1924. That was the only time scientists documented this creature. And Peter went on a quest to see if perhaps there was still one out there somewhere.
I went up to what's now the Gilgit-Baltistan region of northern Pakistan, which is one of the more mountainous regions in the world. It's where the Himalayas and the Karakorams and the Hindu Kush mountain ranges all come together in this gigantic mash of mountains. So I spent most of my time, both in 1992 and then when I returned in 1994, hiking up into these incredible mountains, camping out for weeks at a time, and setting live traps out. And I caught a lot of interesting animals, but no actual woolly flying squirrels. It wouldn't be surprising if there were lots of woolly flying squirrels there because it was such an incredibly vertical landscape that you could have woolly flying squirrels, you know, up on a ledge above your head and you'd never know it. And then after about, I think, a couple of weeks of not catching anything in this big valley, a local fellow came out of the bushes, basically, and he had a Kalashnikov on his back and was quite an impressive bearded fellow. And he said, I hear you were looking for Sergei. And I said, yes. And he said, I will bring you one if you will give me $40. And I figured he had the gun, so why not? So I said, sure. And he wandered off and came back 6 hours later with a live woolly flying squirrel in the bag.
That was Peter Zahler talking about his rediscovery of the woolly flying squirrel. Stories like this are more common than you might think. And when they happen, they are documented online by a project called Lost and Found. Its founder is Diogo Verissimo. He is a researcher at the University of Oxford.
And I'm currently in Anchorage, Alaska, on what is my honeymoon trip, actually.
Your honeymoon trip?
I know, yes.
And you're talking to me? That's very nice.
I know. That's because, yeah, I care deeply about this topic. So, you know, I think it's well worth the time.
Oh, great. Tell me about the Lost and Found project. How did it come about?
Lost and Found came about as an attempt to shift the conversations that we see more commonly around nature and conservation. It really tries to present a more optimistic, a more positive side of all different work that goes on around the world, nature conservation, species preservation, all of that. More often, we used to hear about things that disappear, things that have disappeared, things that will disappear in the future. But there's actually another side to it. There's also a number of creatures that we thought were lost forever, but actually have then sort of returned to us, have been rediscovered. And some of these stories are really not only incredible stories of, you know, on their own right, but also really showcase the true passion and the dedication that a lot of people put into looking for these animals and plants.
What kind of evidence is required to say, this is the real deal, this species is not extinct, we really saw it?
Well, I think that is the type of question where if you have 10 scientists in a room, you get 11 answers. So certainly in the United States recently, we've seen some controversies around exactly that sort of question. How do we know if something's really back, if something is really has been really rediscovered? And so I would say, if you want to be, you know, uncontroversial, I think traditionally you rely on either some actual physical material. So it might be some, you know, feathers, or it might be some other form of little bit of tissue that we can then run genetic testing on and really verify that this is the actual species that we're looking for. Or if not, then high quality either video or footage.
If a species has been rediscovered, are there certain protections being put in place to make sure it doesn't go extinct again?
I think that's the expectation, that after the rediscovery, there'll be more public interest and that will lead to more protection. For example, the woolly flying squirrels is one of those stories where with Peter's rediscovery, then the Wildlife Conservation Society grew increasingly interested in that region and led to the development of a big country program that lasts still till today, I believe.
Do you have a species you would just love to rediscover?
Well, so I would say that from the time I was a child, the species that I've probably thought about rediscovering the most, or how spectacular it would be, it's actually a U.S.-based species, and that's the passenger pigeon. At one point, it was the most abundant species of bird on Earth. The flocks of this species, because it migrates, hence the name passenger, they would go from horizon to horizon, just cover the entire sky. I believe it was early 20th century that the last one died in, I believe, the Cincinnati Zoo. It was a pigeon that was called Martha after George Washington's wife.
Diogo Verissimo is a researcher at the University of Oxford. His project is online at lostandfoundnature.com.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center supports The Pulse. With community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey, Penn's Heart and Vascular Center has made a commitment to deliver advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Our show today is about another life, how people and things can morph, change, make a comeback. Vintage video games, yes, the no-frills, pixelated kind of video games, they are super popular in some circles.
It's a social thing. It's always been a social thing.
The fact that I get to, just come back to 1980s.
I think it's because, it brings you back to being a kid again.
Around the country, there are now video arcades where you can play all of these games from the 80s and 90s. And this comeback is made possible by frequent repairs and hunting down outdated parts. Reporter Colleen Pellissier has this story.
It's Saturday night, and I'm at the Galloping Ghost, a vintage arcade outside of Chicago. I feel as though I've left the 21st century. I'm back in time, somewhere between 1970 and 1990.
Rival Schools, Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, Dragon Spirit, Dragon Saber, Trug, Space Lord.
There are nearly 500 vintage video games, all boxy machines standing about 6 feet tall. They have fixed joysticks, red and blue buttons, pixelated monitors with muffled dinging and pinging sounds.
Pinbot, Black Knight, Space Invaders.
That's Doc Mack. He's the Galloping Ghost owner and curator. He's self-taught. He's the guy who fixes the games when they break, and they all break.
It's something that we just kind of expect. The machine maintenance has to be priority number one, otherwise we would just be one of those other arcades that eventually close.
Today's video games have realistic graphics and intricate storylines. Plus, you can download them straight to your smartphones. But at the Galloping Ghost, Asteroids is about as high-tech as it gets. There's just 13 sound effects, and the entire game world takes place on a black screen. There's a small white triangle, that's your ship. The more asteroids you hit, the more points you get. That's about it. Some of these classic video games are over 30 years old. That's ancient in the tech world. Doc and his team cannibalize defunct games to keep others running.
There's a lot of little things you can be looking for. Sometimes the game will be on the screen, but all the colors won't be there. It'll either be missing the red, green, or blue, and then we have to pull the monitor out and work on that separately.
Off in a back room, there's space reserved for games that need special attention. The consoles are unplugged, backs open, guts on display. It's a mess of wires and dust and rusty parts.
This is a Stratovox, which is a game by Taito. One bad thing is they go down a lot. This one, it has to be looked at almost daily. So I'm trying to find out exactly what's wrong with it. And it looks like it's a power issue. So we're just going to put in a new power supply today.
Doc shines a light on the console, sits on the ground, ducks his head inside the game.
Basically, I'm starting by finding the AC line, which is basically the power that comes from the wall.
He works quickly, drilling, snipping, splicing, and rewiring. Doc says it's important to keep as many of the original parts working as possible. But a few years ago, in an effort to get the machines up and running quickly, he and his team installed LCD monitors. Later, they decided that was a mistake. Doc thought the LCD picture looked a little too sharp.
I'm kind of a purist, so over the last year and a half, we've gotten rid of all of our LCD monitors and are back using CRTs for every single machine in the arcade.
It takes a constant supply of parts to keep the games running.
Bunch of monitors, joysticks, power supplies, connectors and adapters, a lot of buttons, a lot of micro switches.
Doc finishes up and checks his repairs.
All right, well, we should be able to test it. Once it's plugged in and the door switch is thrown, it will go. And it looks like it's working. It's all good.
Colleen Pellissier originally produced this story for Distillations, a podcast about science, culture, and history from the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Today we're talking about getting a new life or a new role. Vintage navigation systems are making a comeback. Think the stars above or using radio waves, because the high-tech system we've all come to rely on is pretty vulnerable.
Turn right onto Edgeland Road.
All right. Can you even imagine your life without GPS? This system works thanks to about 30 satellites orbiting the Earth, regularly pinging information back to Earth. The GPS receiver on your phone picks up those signals from at least 3 satellites and then calculates how long it took for the pings to get there. That makes it possible to figure out where you are.
You have arrived at your destination.
But it's not that hard to tinker or interfere with GPS systems.
If somebody wanted you to be lost for various reasons, they could jam the signal coming from satellites to prevent you from knowing where you are.
That's Sean Gallagher. He is IT editor for the tech news site Ars Technica.
Jamming and spoofing happen with some regularity around North Korea to ships that are traveling near North Korea, and sometimes in the Black Sea. The Russians have been known to jam GPS.
And it's happened in the U.S., too. For example, at Newark International Airport.
A truck driver who was using a GPS jammer to block the signal for a system his employer used to track him actually interfered with the navigation system at Newark International Airport.
Whoa. That's a lot more than he intended to do, I guess.
And that's because it doesn't take that much of a signal to interfere with GPS. Because the signal is relatively weak coming from a satellite, any ground-based signal is going to be stronger than the satellite signal and override it.
And because GPS is vulnerable, an older navigation system is seeing the light of day once again. This is something the Coast Guard was very proud of in the 1940s.
Something new in navigation was at work.
That's from a 1947 Coast Guard film.
It was secret. Top secret. One of the war's most precious. Those on the inside, those that knew, used a strange new word to describe it. That word was LORAN. Long Range Navigation.
Sean Gallagher was in the Navy in the 1980s, and that system was still in place. It was called LORAN-C by then.
LORAN-C covered with its radio beacons most of the North Atlantic and most of the coastal areas of the United States and Canada and Europe and most of the Mediterranean and a good portion of the Pacific. If you have 2 radio beacons that you can pick up the signal from, those radio beacons carry time information, much like GPS does. and it tells you when the signal is broadcast. And since we know when the signal is broadcast and we understand how fast radio waves travel, we can use that information to get a difference in time between when it was sent and when it was received.
It simply determines how much longer one pulse takes to reach the ship than the other pulse.
And that tells us how far away the station was. So if you know where two stations are, or if you have two stations that you have signals from, and you know how far away you are from both of them, you can fix your location on the planet.
South Korea has been on the forefront of bringing back LORAN because North Korea has been jamming GPS signals.
South Korean fishing fleets will go out and they will have to come back immediately because they don't know where they are. They've lost track of where they are in the charts, and they turn around and go home. And that has an economic impact. And there was a new technology for LORAN called Enhanced LORAN, or eLORAN, that South Korea is pushing to have implemented by 2019. And that will allow them to have three stations, and it will offer almost the same accuracy as GPS.
And you can't jam the LORAN?
No, because it depends on such a much stronger signal, and because the signals are locked into specific locations. So because it's a terrestrial system, and because you would have to essentially build a bigger antenna someplace in line with it to broadcast to interfere with it, it's pretty easy to tell where somebody trying to jam you is.
The U.S. is working on bringing back LORAN as well, but first, all of the stations have to be resurrected. And Sean says other old navigation techniques are making a comeback, too.
The Naval Academy now teaches people how to navigate by the stars again, which is something that hadn't been formally taught for some time. So naval officers in training are getting experience using a sextant to take lines on the position of the sun and mark the locations of stars relative to them and use that and charts to figure out where they are.
Sean Gallagher is the IT editor for Ars Technica. We've been talking about getting another life, and our last story takes us into a pretty weird basement.
In here, I have a pet cat thawing out. She's still frozen solid, and you can see her kind of curled up like that.
Beth Beverly is a taxidermist. She makes hats, jewelry, home decor items with parts of dead animals, fur, hoofs, skulls, paws, and she occasionally stuffs people's pets, dead pets, of course.
So a lot of people want, instead of just burying or cremating their pets, they want something that they can display and touch and kind of have as a physical totem for their memories. This is the carcass cast of a dog, a very small dog, and next to it is her hide, which has been professionally tanned. So you can see it's been stripped of any fat or sinew or any kind of tissue. This dog's name was Pearl, and she was a Pekingese. I usually advise people to get their pet into a frozen state, and then I'll thaw him or her out, and I skin them, and then send the hide off to get tanned, and then pose the carcass in whatever way the person wants them to be set. So I pose the carcass that way, freeze it, then make a silicone mold out of the whole thing, and then inject two-part foam into it, and you have an exact replica. It's not the prettiest thing to look at because you're basically looking at an exact replication of the carcass of a skinned dog. Once you put some fur on an animal, it'll look cute again. Beautiful coat. I like it when they have really long hair like this. Just a cute little button nose. The client wants Pearl to be sleeping, which is always easier for me because then I don't have to worry about the expression of the face so much. It's a much more relaxed, closed eye. Normally I would order custom glass eyes. Pearl 2.0 will look, the goal is for Pearl 2.0 to look as close to how she looked sleeping as she did when she was animated. So I have photographs to work with and measurements and dimensions, and I just do the best I can. You can't give me enough photographs. Every angle, every position through the years. And the more photographs and references I have, the better a job I can do. But I also make it clear, like, you're not going to have your pet back. I need to drape the hide over the form, but I wish it was as simple as just that, because there's a lot of fitting and refitting, filing down, adding clay, taking away, and then fitting again. There's usually a tight spot around the neck, and I can already tell I'm gonna need to add a bunch of clay around the chin. You tuck the lips into the mouth. The fitting the hide on is probably what takes the longest, and then once you get it right, you stitch it up. Once I have it on the mannequin, and I have it stitched up and all positioned the way I like it, then I'll comb it out and blow dry it. There's more hair supplies here in my studio than I've ever used for myself. It's very rewarding because then you see, oh, it does look like an animal. It does look like a cute little dog.
Beth Beverly is the owner of Diamond Tooth Taxidermy.
It's gonna have like a literal shelf life because it will be on a shelf for many years to come.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Alan Yu. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager and Alex Stern are our associate producers. Tanya English is our managing editor, and Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated health care.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.